The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Before the podcast begins, I would like to share with you some exciting news. Louis has released a knockout second title, Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. Round 2 from the amazing life and times of legendary South Florida attorney Louis Ress takes readers from Brooklyn in the 1940s, via a spell in a top-secret army department, and a transatlantic solo flight in a replica Spirit of St. Louis, to adventures in and out of the courtroom, in a sometimes rougher-than-ready 50s and 60s Miami. The book is available now on Amazon, just search Louis Ress. And before we start, don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs. And now let's begin.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. I'm Jeanette Garcia, your host, and today we'll be doing episode 30, Why Don't You Become a Judge? Louis, why don't you become a judge? You've been a lawyer. Have you ever thought about becoming a judge?
How did you know my next discussion is, why don't you become a judge? All lawyers harbor feelings about wanting to become a judge. I did. Every Jewish mother at one time or another engages in a conversation with her friends. You know, the Jewish culture. Mm-hmm. They want to be lawyers, doctors,
right.
Dentists, judges, CPAs. So, do you know what a CPA is? A Jewish CPA?
No.
That's a Jewish boy who can't stand the sight of blood and stutters.
Oh, that's a good one.
I wasn't going to tell it. So it goes like this. The Jewish woman number one says, my son Harold is a dentist in New Jersey with 2 chairs.
Oh.
So the number two, the woman, Jewish woman number two, was not going to let her get away with it. She says, what do you mean? My son Arnold lives in the Five Towns in Long Island, and he's some doctor.
Huh. Okay.
Oh, now the third woman trumps it all. She knows. She says, number three says, my son, his honor, Michael, is a judge.
Oh.
Game over.
That's it.
Game over.
So I guess it's that great to be a judge then, huh?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. Like anything else, it's got its good and bad points, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of give and take. Here's a funny story about becoming a judge. My friend Bob Sapphire, that's not his real name. He lives in Williams Island. He was a former councilman there. He tells the story about how he grew up in a small town in northern New Jersey. He had a modest law office, and he engaged in local politics. Before he became the mayor, he was the municipal judge. This required about 2 hours a week on a Wednesday in the evening, listening to traffic cases. One night, he had to go into New York City on business, and he couldn't be there on that Wednesday. So he called up one of his friends, Bill Johnson, and he said, Bill, could you cover for me for the next Wednesday? Bill says, it's not a problem. So Bill went over to City Hall, and he was sworn in by the municipal clerk. It took about 5 minutes. On Wednesday night of the next week, he shows up at City Hall and listens to the police describe each traffic violation and the mostly inadequate explanations. Almost all of the people charged pleaded guilty with explanation. There were 7 cases, and it took about 1 hour and 45 minutes, and that was it. The next morning, my friend Bob calls over to Bill Johnson's office to see how it had gone, and the phone is answered, Law Office of Judge William Johnson.
Oh.
The letter had been changed to Judge William Johnson, Attorney at Law.
Okay.
Business cards were changed. The telephone listing was changed. And when his wife made reservations at the restaurant, it was for Judge and Mrs. William Johnson.
Wow. Is it really true? How do you become a real judge?
Well, it is true. I mean, that's a true story. One road is to become a prosecutor. I would put that on hold for a little bit. But almost all lawyers in the county prosecutor's office want to be judges.
Hmm.
In the early days, it meant a jump from $35,000 a year to $130,000 a year.
That's pretty
now,
good.
It's changed a little bit. It's now about three times. So it's about 40,000 to about 100 and, well, three times 130, 140,000. So maybe 160,000. So it's a huge jump.
Oh, yeah.
It means medical benefits, excellent retirement, and most importantly, respect. You get a black robe. You sit up there on the on the bench looking down on the proceedings taking place. All rise. Here comes the judge. And there was a whole joke and a song and a show called Here Come the Judge. Here Come the Judge.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The judge comes dancing down the hall in the black robe.
Now, what about you or your partner or associates becoming a judge? Did anyone you know?
Well, my partner, George Case, was well known in Miami, and he had been an attorney for the school board. He went to the University of Florida Law School, and he was Blue Key, which was the exclusive honor society.
Okay.
George was a little older, having been a fighter pilot in the South Pacific during World War II.
Wow.
His family came from the Bahamas to Key West generations ago, and then to Miami. Originally, he was my boss. Then he was my senior partner. And gradually, after I began to produce substantial fees, we became equal partners. You know who Horatio Alger is?
No, I don't.
Horatio Alger was the American Dream story.
Oh, yes. Yes, you mentioned it in our last
to riches,
one. Yes.
You know?
Rags to riches,
I'll tell you
yes.
more about it. You know, Horatio Alger said, work hard, be honest, be reliable, be charitable, and you're bound to succeed.
Right.
That was Horatio Alger.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody knows anything about who he really was and what he did. I'll tell you more about him. Because a lot of people used him, particularly in past generations, like one or two generations back. They would talk about Horatio
talk
Alger.
About
he wrote,
guy.
He wrote a whole bunch of novels, you know, penny novels, 10-cent novels. And people believed in it. But I still believe in America, and it's the land of opportunity. George and I, my partner and I, spent a lot of time in the office entertaining clients and on the tennis courts and in each other's homes and in various bars, and our wives hit it off. And I always thought that George might become a judge because everyone liked him and he was very politically connected. George and I made a rule that neither of us would leave the other without a family vote, and that the majority would prevail. George was a great guy. He was well-liked and respected. He was admired by everyone who came into contact with him. His friends from childhood and his fraternity brothers from the University of Florida were successful attorneys. They were political bigwigs, and they were judges. He seemed to know everybody, including the governor, the entire Florida Supreme Court, and many of the appellate judges. They were in the civil court of record, his friends, which heard small cases, and the circuit court, which had unlimited jurisdiction, and the appellate courts. He knew the governor by his first name.
Huh.
It wasn't a surprise that he was, in fact, offered a circuit court judgeship.
Is that the more prevalent road? Like who you know kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm going to save that a little bit and come back to you about that. But it is who you know, as a matter of fact. What happened next was that the family met. So we had a discussion, and I said, George, what do you need this for? You have to run for re-election every 6 years. It's demeaning. You have to go out and seek money contributions for your campaign. You will probably have to create a committee for re-election composed mostly of trial lawyers. The lawyers will contribute money because they will appear in front of you hoping to reap a reward. You know?
Yeah, that's true. You mentioned that. That it comes, you have to, you know, sometimes be right with a lawyer and that's with a judge, and that's one way to do it, kind of support them during their election.
A lot of politics, both in and out of the courts.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have to set the fees of many of these attorneys. And if you rule in favor of someone else, they will say that justice was served. If you rule in favor of them, they'll say justice was served. If you rule against them, they'll say they'll get you someday, no matter what they have to do. You'll make enemies.
Yeah.
What's even worse is someday you can have a case involving the Miami Herald, the newspaper. If you rule against them, you do it at your peril, because they publish a list of recommendations before every election, and they're extremely influential. People take that list and they go into the voting booth with it, and if they don't put your name down for judgeship, you're finished.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's because you ruled against him. You will have to give up your practice. George, you earn $135,000 a year as a judge. You make that now in 1 month. Your personal life will be public knowledge. One misspoken word will cause a scandal. One traffic ticket can damage your campaign.
Was he listening to you?
No, he wasn't. But finally, I reached him. I said, George, it's like a fight business, you know, like boxing. The judge is the referee, and he stands in the center of the ring, and he says, I want to see a clean fight. Give these people their money's worth. Keep your guard up at all times. Now go to the neutral corner and come out fighting. Then the referee says, break clean when they tangle. And he holds the winner's hand up in the air, and he says, you're the champ. But the referee is never the champ. He's not even a contender.
Yeah. Did you get through to George with this illusion?
Yeah, that finally did it. When he realized he would never be a champ, he would only be a contender. Mm-hmm. The family vote was unanimous. No judgeship for George.
Oh, well, isn't a judgeship like a charmed kind of life? Or not exactly? It doesn't seem like it from your description.
No, it isn't really. Although many people think it is, and a lot of lawyers think it is, it's not a charmed life. In any event, I thought that maybe I was too strong in my criticism of the thought of George becoming a judge until I got a call from Joe Stanton. I don't know if you remember Joe Stanton.
Yeah, it sounds a little familiar. Remind me again?
Well, he was the plaintiff's lawyer with the Sams firm with whom I tried the famous position of the lion case.
Oh, okay.
Which
okay.
I'll tell you about in the next in a forthcoming podcast. Position of the lion. Position of the Lion was a very sexy case about a woman who was like a nun, and we talked about her personal sex life in the trial.
Okay.
Joe is a very good lawyer, Joe Stanton, and he came from a very well-known family. They were in Florida for generations and generations, and I think it was Senator Smathers who nominated him for the federal district court judgeship. At any rate, he was appointed to the federal bench, and it's a lifetime appointment, highly sought after. A federal judgeship is the holy grail for most lawyers. I'm sure that my partner George Case would have grabbed it if it had been offered to him. He never got up to the point of being a federal judge. Well, I get a call, and he said, it was Judge Stanton on the phone. He says, Lewis, how are you? I was thinking of you and the case we tried together. How about coming down to the courthouse and visiting with me? I said, Joe, I mean, Your Honor, you know, I would surely enjoy that very much. So I went down to meet Judge Stanton in his chambers in the federal courthouse one afternoon, and he was in civilian clothes, wearing a light tan sport coat over a white short sleeve shirt, khaki slacks, and penny loafers. He really had a large office with a bank of windows down the whole line of the side of the office, and he sat behind a huge desk, and I sat at the side of the desk. He evidently just wanted to talk to somebody, anyone, even me.
And was he cordial?
Oh, he was very cordial, yeah. He said, Lewis, I remember you, the beating you gave me.
Yeah.
I said, Judge, you know, I really enjoyed working with you, and I knew that we were both just doing our jobs. How do you like being a federal judge? He said, Lewis, it's lonely. I can't have lunch with any of my attorney friends.
Oh.
The other judges all go their own way. There are rules about everything. I'm not free. I can't go where I want to or what I want to do without repercussions. It's not what it appears to be. There's a person in Washington, D.C. who keeps track of every ruling I make, particularly if the federal government is involved. And if I rule against the government too often, I'm in trouble.
Wow. I thought that he was appointed a judge for life.
That's true. So I asked him, I said, what can they do to you? You have a lifetime appointment. He said, well, when vacations come up, I can't get off during the summer when the kids are out of school. You see my office here? Well, I would get moved to the basement if I am unpopular. And the worst secretary in the pool would be assigned to me. And the telephones would be black, not colored. And the rugs down there are threadbare instead of what you see. That's just the beginning. You know, every year, the district judge in Alaska comes down to Miami for the month of February. And a judge, usually from Miami, is assigned to Fairbanks. And it can be the same judge each time. You don't want to be in Fairbanks in February.
Would they really do that to a federal judge?
Indeed, they would. Indeed. Judge Stanton continued. What really is upsetting is that I am assigned to try criminal cases, cases involving drug cartels. These are lengthy, boring, mean cases. These people are vicious killers. Witnesses disappear or wind up dead. The remaining witnesses won't testify. Jurors are threatened or bribed. You're in danger. You can't go out for a cup of coffee. Your house is surrounded by agents to protect you. Bodyguards are with you and your family day and night. But what about your wife and kids? They're also fair game. The kids have security around them all the time, at school and at play. So are your parents under threat. Just as well, your brothers and your sisters are under threat. You know, Lewis, that the government can't protect all of them. I suppose that someday a judge's family will be murdered. I live in fear.
It's terrible. It's terrifying.
He was right. He was right, and I'll tell you more about it. Well, I looked at him, and his left eye had a slight twitch. And he said, judgeship is not what it's cracked up to be.
Well, Lewis, yeah, it doesn't seem like it, I guess, from his perspective. Do you have any insight on that?
I do. I do. I can tell you the good things and the bad things about the judgeships, okay? I'll start off with the good things, okay?
Yeah.
The good things is you really don't have to work all the time, nights, weekends, give up vacations the way a trial judge, a trial attorney does. Trial attorneys are under pressure all the time, day and night, 7 days a week, all year time. And once you, if a case gets settled or something, then you plan your vacations around that.
Around it, yeah.
You don't have to worry about the results of a trial. You know, trying cases, it's around 50-50, winning and losing a case. So no matter which side you're on, you got about a 50 chance of winning and a 50 chance of losing. Mm-hmm. After a while, that statistic catches up with you and you lose a few cases in a row. You may lose clients that are litigating that are bringing you the cases.
Right.
So it's a lot of pressure. What about deadlines? The courts have deadlines. You have to do, and it's in the rules. Mm-hmm. You have to appeal in so many days. You have so many days to file certain papers. You have so many days within to complete certain tasks. And if you don't do it, you know, it's malpractice. Hmm. Judges aren't quite like that. They may have to write lengthy opinions, but they have plenty of time to do it. Nobody's saying you have to write it overnight. Hmm. There are a few occasions when the judge are pressured, but not the way lawyers are.
Oh, okay.
What about bringing in business? If you don't bring in business, you can't produce fees. If you don't produce fees, you can't pay the office overhead. You can't make a living. The judge doesn't have to worry about bringing in business.
Yeah, no worries. It's always coming.
What about charging and collecting fees? Once you bring the case in, you've got to set a fee with the client, and then you've got to collect it. And a lot of clients will agree and then not pay you. They get ahead of you in the money flow. You can't get out of the case. You got to keep going forward, and they're not paying you. It's a lot of them go bankrupt. A lot of checks bounce on you. So that's these are problems in the practice that the judges don't have. You don't have overhead. What about paying employees? In a law office, you may have two or three people working directly under you, and plus you have bookkeepers and you have office managers and receptionists. That all has to be paid for, and the lease and the insurance. Though you don't have that as a judge. What about laying out costs? In a trial, the lawyers generally lay out the costs. What are the costs? Well, expert witness fees and travel expenses and depositions and court reporters and such.
You don't have to worry about any of that.
Right.
Yeah.
What about bringing in clients and keeping clients? You have to go out and meet new people all the time, but wherever you do it, whether you do it in business organizations or in social organizations, Kiwanis, Rotary Club, the Country Club, whatever, you're always handing out cards and shaking hands and buying drinks and entertaining and having dinners. Judges don't have to do that. And what about keeping clients? To keep them from leaving you, you make sure that you do their personal matters for nothing and look after them. Make sure that they like you and that they're satisfied with your work. That sometimes that takes a lot of effort. What about producing billable hours? If you're working in a firm that's based on billable hours, you've got to put them in. And that means they're not looking for 40 hours a week. They're looking for 80 hours a week. So then retirement. The judge doesn't have to worry about retirement. They've got it all built in.
Yeah,
So,
all the
and then
benefits and
they
everything.
have senior status. A judge can, after he retires, become a senior judge and sit specially when they need him, and get paid for that.
Oh.
In addition, he can become a mediator or an arbitrator, or even what they call private judges, rent a judge, where you
Oh.
can, yeah, that's something that people don't know about.
Yeah, first time I hear about that.
Right, two
Rent a
parties don't want to
judge.
wait 3 years for the case to come up. They get a judge who's retired, recently retired, to sit and conduct a trial for them, a private trial, and they can
Rent
get
a
the matter
judge.
resolved that way. It's better
Wow.
than arbitration because the rules apply, the rules of practice, the rules of procedure apply. What about health insurance? It's
Yeah.
provided for. What about the prestige? Here comes the judge. The judge and Mrs. Brown wants a reservation or the country club. It's nice when you apply to membership in the country club to say you're a judge. It's a lot better than saying you're an attorney looking for business. So, what are some of the negatives? Okay.
Yeah, let's get into it. What?
Okay.
Why
Well,
wouldn't you become a judge, Lewis?
okay. Well, the first thing is I told you that the prosecutor. Is making well, the prosecutor gets a big raise. He's making $41,500 a year in Dade County. He goes up to $160,688, 4 times what he's making. But when you're an attorney practicing law, I'll give you an example of one of my good acquaintances, who I would even call a friend, who is now a justice on the Florida Supreme Court. He had a drop of 730% of his
Wow.
income. He went,
Whoa.
he makes $220,600 a year as a Supreme
Why?
Court justice.
But why is it so low? Wouldn't it, doesn't
That's
it
not
make,
low. You
yeah,
don't
but in
understand about America.
comparison, but in comparison to, it's a heavy job though. I mean,
Yes,
it is an
but the
important
people
job,
who are
especially at that
the
level.
taxpayers who are paying him are making $15
That's
an
true.
hour.
Yes, that's true.
They don't like to see a guy making $22,600
Yeah,
for
that's
sitting on
true.
the bench in a robe
But
who's
then again,
retiring.
doesn't it open it up then for like corruption then? In a, maybe not at that level, but
Not at that level.
at the state
No,
level maybe,
I would
or
say
county level?
huge number of judges are above corruption. What they are, they're subject to being influenced, but not bribed.
Right.
I'll tell you a little bit about that. But my friend went from making 1.6 million, which is not a lot of money for a successful attorney, really successful, down
How much
to,
is a lot if that's not
well, I don't want to tell you how much I
lot?
made, but it was a lot more than that.
Yeah, okay.
And I did because I was hardworking, and a lot of my cases were based on the results that I obtained as opposed to the hours. I didn't work by the hour most of the time. Most of the time, I worked by the results. I had some basic clients that covered my overhead that I worked for by the hour.
Right.
But the big money was on results. So, like my friend Larry, when I entered a con I got a contract for him to do mining, and he made $2 million, and I did the contract
Yeah.
in 8 hours or 10 hours.
Made good
He was
money.
he didn't pay me for 8 or 10 hours worth of time.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of thing. Then you have to get reappointed or run for re-election as a judge. And then you're assigned cases that are very b often boring. Then you have to attend dinners and meetings, and you can't be friendly with the attorneys. But when the head of the FBI came down, which is in charge of federal judges, all those judges showed up at the cocktail party for him. Every federal judge showed
Yeah.
up, including the ones I knew. They were told to be there at the Biltmore Hotel at such and such. The head of the FBI was coming down. And having a cocktail party, and
Right,
they were there. Then the vacation time is limited, and you're in the public scrutiny all your time, all the time, and you can't be friendly with the attorneys. But that's the least of it. That's the least of it. The real stuff is
Yeah, tell us the real stuff, Lewis. What's
okay.
like the dark
I'm
stuff?
going to tell you the real stuff. I was saving this. I gotta find it, but I'll because I want to give you a book and verse. But the real stuff
Yeah,
is
'cause you mentioned something
when,
about, like their lives being threatened or their family's lives
yeah,
being threatened. That's serious.
right. Exactly. Right. One, I'm trying to think of the names of the judges, but one judge was had her son and her husband.
Judge Esther Salas?
Yeah.
Was that?
Yeah. It was, as I recall, Esther Salas was her name,
mm-hmm.
and she was in Brunswick, New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
And she had a case. I think it was an anti-feminist lawyer that went after her. And he came to the house and he shot her. He shot her husband and her son. And it killed her husband.
My gosh.
And he was, he came to the front door as a delivery man.
Wow.
And opened fire. Then there was Judge Joan Lefkow's husband and her mother. They were shot dead by a party to a lawsuit that was before her in court. Actually, the assailant had hidden her basement to shoot her.
Wow.
But he didn't see her, so he shot her family. So he killed her husband and her mother. This was not too long ago. So,
that's, yeah, it's disturbing.
Yeah, you know, it is very, very, very disturbing. You think about it. Well, there were over 4,500 documented threats and inappropriate communications that were recorded against federal judges in 1 year.
Wow.
So that's how bad it is.
Mm-hmm.
The safety of the families is a major, major problem. Then you have, there's a lot more. The judges, they're game, they're fair game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mostly the criminals and
right.
the gangs
mm-hmm.
and the drug dealers that go after. They're not afraid of killing anybody.
Yeah.
So you risk your life to take a loss in income, to have to run for office, or to be subject to criticism and to have your life reviewed. And if you have one false step, you're in trouble. I don't think it's a good deal.
Yeah, you don't think it's worth it.
And then you get, you know, you get raided and everything. To me, it's a mistake. It's a terrible mistake. I can tell you some more stuff about judges.
Yeah, you mentioned something about being raided or judged.
Yeah,
yep.
Right. They get raided and they get evaluated. And there's an organization. If you say the wrong thing in court, you can get censured. There is a first, I'm going to tell you about Horatio Alger a little bit.
Yes.
Because
yes.
I didn't finish on him.
Yeah, tell us about him.
He was the rags to riches author.
Mm-hmm.
And however, he went to Harvard.
Okay.
And he was the son of a Unitarian minister. And he studied religion. He went to the Divinity School at Harvard. And he was tutored in the classics. And he attended Gates Academy. So this was not exactly a kid from the wrong
from
side
rags.
Of the tracks, you know, working in the coal mines and finding a diamond and giving it to the boss and saying, sir, this diamond is not mine. It belongs to the
right.
company. And then they make him the executive officer of the company because he was so honest. That's not exactly the story of Horatio Alger. He was eighth in his class of 88 at Harvard. So he was Phi Beta Kappa. Remember I told you at the top 10%?
Yeah.
So he was Phi Beta Kappa. Okay, what you don't know about Horatio Alger is that on at least two occasions, he was charged with sexually molesting young boys.
Oh, wow.
And he never controverted it. He left the schools where he was working.
Okay.
And I think he
Might
paid
well
some indemnification. And so he wasn't, and he had two kids that were living with him all the time.
He took
in young kids, and God knows what was going on.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's Horatio
Alger. So that's the story. Wow.
Right. So how do you become a judge?
Let's go back to that, yeah.
That was one of the things. Why don't you become a judge? Well, you don't just become a judge by being a prosecutor. That's one road. But there are a number of roads to becoming a judge. But you have to have a law degree most of the time. What judgeship don't you have to have a law degree for? Do you know?
No.
United States Supreme Court.
Okay.
It's, I think, one of the only courts
Huh.
in the country where you don't need a law degree. And there are all kinds of courts, and I'll tell you more about that. But most of the small courts, like a municipal court or something, may not have to hear traffic cases, or a small claims court to hear cases, let's say under $1,000, that they may not require a law degree. Most of the time, you have to be admitted to the bar in the jurisdiction where you're serving. Okay, you have administrative judges and magistrates also may not. Magistrates hear smaller cases or do tasks for the judges above them.
I see. Okay.
So they may, they may do some research. They make findings of fact. They may have some hearings, take some testimony, and then make recommendations to the judge. But they're not judges. And you have to run for political office. So it's political. So that means you have to go to the political party. You have to raise money. You have to be on the ballot. Well, how do you get on the ballot for a judgeship? If you're in a, let's say, a Republican area, you better be endorsed by the Republican Party. Well, how do you get endorsed by the Republican Party? You start out doing small things, small tasks, getting a job as a clerk, maybe an assistant, an administrator, a supervisor, and then maybe a run for some a minor public office, like a clerk of some kind. And then you're picked to become a judge. You stand on a line, you're on a list, and you go down, play the piano, pour drinks at the club, and get to know the judges, light their cigars for them. And then they say, okay, your time has come and you can be a judge. And that's how a lot of people become judges.
Wow.
A governor fills temporary vacancies. Someone dies in office or resigns or decides not to run. The judge may appoint from the unexpired term, can appoint you. And then you run, and then they back you.
Right.
So that's
So that's another way.
So getting into, you have to get into politics.
Hmm.
You clerk for a judge. Clerkship is another good way.
And how long? Like, is there like a process? Like, is there a time frame
Well,
that's
24 states have no need for legal experience. So the other 25, 26 states do require.
Is Florida one of them?
Yeah, you have to have some experience depending on the judgeship that you're going for. You have to be practicing for a certain number of years. So one of the ladies who was appointed to the Supreme Court of Florida by the governor didn't have the number of years of practice, and she
Oh.
was not able to accept the judgeship. She was put out just recently. Okay, does that help you?
Yeah.
You have then you go, you have to have training. So after that, you may go to the National Judicial College and you study judicial ethics, and you learn about it. You learn how to be a judge. You learn the qualities of being a judge, to be critical thinking, logical thinking. You have to learn to how to listen, how to be engaged in problem solving. You have to have social perceptiveness. You have to be able to speak logically and write. And you have to be able to handle negotiations. You have to have reading comprehension. You can't be a moron. You got to know how to read. And you have to have a concept of time management. You have to be an administrator to run your courtroom in a proper way. You have to be impartial. You can't show emotions or prejudices. You have to be patient. So those are some of the qualities, and you take courses before you go on the bench. And there's a JQC in Florida, the Judicial Qualifications Commission. And if they have a complaint against you, they just like the Bar Association, you've got to come in and defend yourself. Then, of course, there are all these courts that you think you know about the court structure, but you don't, because there's a court for highly spe the law practice is divided into every aspect of society. Whatever aspect of society is, there's law relating to it. These are the outer limits or the fencing areas, the fenced-in boundaries of behavior that you can engage in within the law. Once you go out of them, it's illegal. Once you stay inside of them, it's legal. And the lawyer's job is to know where these boundaries are and what's inside and what's outside of them. Sometimes the courts are always making decisions on these very close cases, and you don't know which is whether your client's on one side of the barbed wire fence or the other side, because the courts vacillate. So it's hard to practice. You have to anticipate. United States Supreme Court gets about 7,000 cases submitted to it every year. Guess how many they take jurisdiction of out of the 7,000?
Probably not many.
130.
Right, very little, huh?
And then I started to talk about the areas of practice, specialized practice. So I can give you some ideas. There's family court, you know, there's bankruptcy. Do you know what admiralty is?
No.
Admiralty is waters, harbors, high seas, anything to do with navigation, naval law. There's military law. There's tax law. There are all the torts, you know, the automobile accidents, airplane accidents, whatever. There's government agencies, administrative law, probate, wills and estates. There's patents and copyrights and intellectual property, aviation, appellate practice, just, you know, on the appeals, employment, unions, labor, and anything, workers' compensation.
There's something for everyone.
Every aspect of society has, but these are separate courts that are just specialized in these in these areas, which is, I find it very interesting.
Yeah.
Immigration, that's another court's structure. So, and then you have the traffic courts.
Is there some way to kind of, is this mapped out in any way, or can it be demonstrated in any way to
No, the citizens? Law schools try to cover it all by, you know, giving you a whole real estate. Real estate's a whole separate thing.
Yeah.
Probate, the courses in these things. But they can't give you a course in every one of these subjects. So you come out of law school ignorant in about 50% of the Middle East, and you wind up having to do self-education.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. It becomes a challenge. And I just I ended. I know it's getting on and on.
No, but I think you alluded to something about them being reviewed and like their conduct. How's their conduct subject to review, and can they be disciplined?
Yeah, well,
because you brought up your friend and how, you know, he can be a judge for life. So what are some of the
well,
exceptions?
They have in Florida. They have the a board called the JQC, the Judicial Qualifications Commission. And you can apply, you can file a complaint there, and the judge has to come in and justify their behavior. They investigate. And if they find that there's a basis for the investigation, the judge has to come in and justify their behavior. You can't be prejudiced. You can't be drunk. You can't take bribes. You can't discriminate. You know, that kind, based on race, sex, religion. You can't bully. Threats from the bench. You have to avoid the appearance of impropriety. So these are some of the things that judges do regularly.
They have to
judge
watch for
gets
it.
Power crazy, and he or she thinks that they are God, and they start talking in a very unfair, dictatorial manner. And,
I mean, you told me some stories, so I've heard some stories of some judges that were not easy.
Well, 25% of all the people in the United States, in fact, in the world probably, are psychiatrically disturbed. And it goes across every line. So you can say one in every five judges is nuts.
Yes. So you're probably right. Yeah.
You're right. You see them driving on I-95. I mean, it's all around you, the nuts.
Yeah.
So they're there. Well, I'll give you an example of some of the problems. A judge, you know, United States Supreme Court, they impeach the judge, you know, so... Abe Fortas was an associate justice in 1969, and he resigned under threat of impeachment because he agreed to act as a paid consultant to a foundation of a man who was under investigation for securities fraud while he was sitting on the bench. You can't take money for doing it.
Yeah.
So they make the And they make crazy decisions, too. And I don't know. I was going to tell you more about the judges getting into trouble, but Abe Fortas is a good example of it. And there are a number of judges who have been censured. Censuring is a big thing.
And once that happens,
a lot of them make terrible decisions and they get away with it. I can tell you some crazy decisions.
And once they're censured, does that mean that's it? It's over for them? Like they can't practice any? Like they can't be a judge anymore?
Right, they're disbarred. Oh, yeah. After the JQC hears the case, they send it up to the Supreme Court of Florida, if that's the next highest court. And then they can throw them and they can discipline them. They can make them get a reprimand in open court, all the way up to being told that they can't be a judge anymore, thrown out. And then it goes to the Florida bar because they have a bar license, which is separate. Judges like to think of themselves as being entirely different occupation than lawyers.
It's very similar.
Just like dentists, different from CPAs. It's different. And they don't feel as though they're acting and practicing law. They're judges. That's a whole separate business. Like referees in baseball. You're either an umpire or a player. They're umpires. So they have a different rule, different organizations, and they do different functions. What else? I'm going to end it by telling you two or three of the worst decisions in the courts. I'll tell you three worst decisions that I think. I was thinking, what are the worst? Well, there's four I'll tell you about. The first one is my dear friend, may she rest in peace, Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Oh, yes.
Who was a wonderful, wonderful human being. But she came up with a decision. You can't find it. It's hard to find. Saying that an automobile is a person. Well, that, of course, was the precursor of Citizens United. So I don't know if you know what Citizens United is.
No, no.
Citizens United, the Supreme Court found, I think it was in 2010, that corporations are people. And therefore, they have a right under the First Amendment to have freedom of speech. That's a whole separate thing. So
yeah, I remember you mentioned that.
They said that they could raise money and use it to influence a political campaign, not make a contribution, but influence the political campaign by making advertisements,
sending out
ads on TV, books, taking ads in newspapers, that kind of stuff, making a movie. In this case, it was a motion picture. About Hillary Clinton, and they had ads for it, and you know, knocking her down. And they were told that they were allowed to do that. They could spend any amount of money they want. That was their freedom of speech, as long as they didn't make a direct contribution to the party. Well, that's nonsense, because why make a direct contribution to the party when you can control the money and use it the way you want to
that's
achieve
true.
The political purpose you're trying to achieve? So you don't have to give it directly to the party.
That's true, yeah.
And the fact that they say corporations are people, corporations are not people. Corporations are used to be responsible as individuals and treated as people, but they're not people. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that a car is a person. How did that happen?
Yikes.
Well, this guy was caught in an automobile full of drugs, and they impounded the car. So it's United States versus 1945 Cadillac or whatever. I made that up. And they do that versus a boat, whatever. They catch the boat with the marijuana on it, and they impound the boat. And they sell them down. You can see them being sold downtown Miami in these auctions, federal auctions. So the wife of the guy who was driving the car said, wait a minute, that's my car. The title is in my name. It belongs to me. And he was driving it without my permission or knowledge. He took the keys. I didn't even know it. It's my car. Give me my car back. And Justice Ginsburg said, oh, no, the car was the one that did wrong. And the car's responsible. And the car's going to pay the penalty. And
I
think
that doesn't set
in all due respect,
there.
I'm sure she's criticizing me from her grave. But then I don't understand.
Why'd you have to bring that up, Lewis?
But that's what it seemed to be to me. And, of course, they do that to deter drugs and illegal use of vehicles or transportation, and also for the economic benefit to the government by impounding those vehicles. But in some instances, if you can show that it's your car and it was stolen from you and you want it back and you weren't involved in the crime, you ought to have some rights also. The wife should have had some rights too. And I think the right, in my opinion, the wife's rights as ownership supersede the husband's abuse. And unless she participated and knew about it, I would say that she was
Did
given
she
a
get her
raw
car back?
deal.
Yeah.
Then you have the two more, Bush versus Gore. You know what that was about?
No.
Oh, you don't. You
No.
do.
I feel ignorant right now.
It's the election of 2000, the presidential election. And
Yeah, I remember the election. I didn't
I
know it
think
was
it was
a
in May 2013 that
case.
this happened. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was the swing vote. She didn't like to be called a swing voter, but she was. This was a ruling to stop the recount in Florida. What happened was Gore was ahead, or Bush was ahead by 327 votes, as I recall. The tabs, remember the tabs and the things, they were holding them up. And so they were supposed to have a recount. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the issue was whether they were going to have a recount in Florida, which is what all the Republicans
I
want.
know, yeah.
Well, now the Republicans didn't want a recount because their man was ahead. People forgot that. They had this belief that if you're ahead, you can justify it by saying no recount. If you're behind, you can justify it by saying, oh, we must have a recount, we must have an accurate vote. Anyhow, it came up for a vote in the Supreme Court. And the deciding vote was cast by Associate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who is a wonderful lady and a bright person and a charming individual and a loving American. She's also a lifelong Republican. And she also made a statement before she made the decision. She was friendly with the Bush family too. She
Oh,
knew them.
gosh.
And she said that she would only retire if a Republican came into office at the time of her retirement
Oh,
so there could be a
wow.
Republican replacement. Okay, and her husband was very ill and she was anxious to retire. In fact,
Yeah.
he was when she did retire, he was non compos mentis. She couldn't have a relationship with him anyhow. He was in la la land.
Wow.
So she said that, and so she would needlessly say benefit from Bush being president as opposed to Gore. So
Yeah, it's clearly
and she
biased.
right, and I think she also made some comment, and I don't quote me on this, but it's a hearsay that she felt a Republican from the Bush family would be a better president for the country as opposed to a Democrat, by Gore, from Gore. So that's what she based her opinion on, politics and not the law.
Yep.
And it was a four to excuse me, a 5-4 ruling. 5-4 ruling. She was the swing vote. If she had voted to send it back to Florida for a recount, it would have been 5-4 the other way.
Yep.
And God knows it was only 327 votes. Gore could have been president and not Bush. So nobody knows about that.
Yeah.
And then there was the worst one. And I told you about Citizens United. I tell you about Dred Scott. All the
Dred Scott.
students of the United States Supreme Court seem to agree that the Dred Scott decision was the worst decision in the history of the United States and the history of the court. And I'm going to end by quickly telling you about it.
Sure.
It was decided by Justice Roger Taney. Although the court was like 7-2 or something in favor of Taney, it wasn't just Taney. There was more pro-slave justices on the Supreme Court than there were anti-slave justices. So if you're in the Black Lives Matter, the first building you want to tear down is the United States Supreme Court, and then rip out all the seats where they sat, where they made these decisions, because this was a lulu.
Yeah.
This was really racist. Dred Scott was a slave, and he was living in a free state, and they were bringing him back to returning him to his owners. And he said, wait a minute, I'm in a free state and I'm married to a woman who's not a slave, and I don't want to be returned to the owner. I'm free. And the court said African Americans, he had to be returned to his owner. He was property. And you can't deprive someone of their property without due process of law and or compensating him for his, for the slave. And that's how they felt about slaves. And then Roger Taney went to town and he said, Afro-Americans were and could not ever become citizens.
Wow.
And they could never vote in federal elections and they had no standing in court.
Wow.
There's a bust of, I looked up the statues of Taney. They don't tell you because there was something recently on television about his bust being in the robing room. That's where they put their robes on in the Supreme Court in a niche in the wall. He was the only one in there. And now they're taking him out, I'm sure. Once they got on TV, they're going to remove that.
Yeah.
But there were two other statues I could find. One was in the state capital of Annapolis, Maryland. I think he was the former governor of Maryland or something.
Oh, okay.
And there was another one, I think, in Virginia that I found. And then I found a street named after him in Philadelphia. I think they're going to change that. But that is the story of the Dred Scott decision and Justice Roger Taney.
What a judge.
So with that, I leave you with the understanding that no judge is faultless and perfect. No court is faultless
Definitely
and perfect.
Not.
No country is faultless and perfect. And we make terrible mistakes. I think one of the worst ones was Citizens United, where they had this dark money coming in and you don't have to disclose the source of it to influence camp. Well, suppose you're Russia and you want to get money in. You form a PAC in the United States. You have some front. You put the money in there and they use it for the political campaign. So
yeah, it just opens the door for more.
Right.
Crime.
So the answer is I don't want to become a judge.
I can see why not. Thank you for sharing all that. That's a wealth of knowledge, as usual. Thank you, Lewis.